Support for this program is brought to you by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Hi, I'm Mitch Skinner, and tonight we're going to do a group project.
They're making all these Shakespearean type jokes, you know, and you're laughing at something stupid, but it's still funny.
And I notice you have a disembodied hand up here. Like, what's with this thing?
Don't take this the wrong way, but basically, I love America, and I wanted to represent what America stood for, which is freedom.
Thanks for joining. Well, students are finally settled in at the University of Minnesota. Classes have been in session for 3 weeks now, and they're starting to get the hang of it. So what next? How to capture that quintessential college experience outside of the classroom? One option is to start looking for some like-minded individuals. Or maybe you want to expand your horizons and find something different. Either way, a good way to do it is to get out of the dorms and test the waters in a student group. So tonight on CultureQ, we're going to showcase some options to explore. We'll find out why you should be getting into opera, and why you shouldn't be getting into some restricted areas on campus. We'll play some sports, and we'll relax with some meditation after. It's all up next on CultureQ, but first, a look at cooperative living. For overworked students at the University of Minnesota, it is essential to have a comfortable place to come home to after being confined in classrooms all day. Many freshmen flock to the dorms to experience a nitty-gritty college lifestyle, but later they might rent an apartment or join a fraternity or a sorority. However, residents at the student co-op subscribe to an often overlooked housing niche. CultureQ reporter Parker Lemke explores.
Among the antique chapter houses lining Frat Row is one three-story white stucco-clad building with a bike hanging over its central window. This is the Student Co-op, a cooperative housing project home to 29 men and women who take pride in their little community, as Nels, one of the co-opers, explained.
A lot of the people that are here are not just here to live, like not just here to have a room, as opposed to the dorms. People come here because they want the community.
A jungle garden of sunflowers and vegetables greets anyone walking up to the Student Co-op's terraced patio. The front door opens to a comfortable, lived-in living room, and crowded bike racks line the walls. Walking down into the affectionately messy kitchen, I met Patrick, who was quick to tell me about the Student Co-op's defining strength.
The people. They're just great people. Become close with them.
As a private housing cooperative, residents of the Student Co-op co-own the house they live in, and work together to maintain it. The aging 100-year-old house has kept generations of student co-opers on their toes, including maintenance manager Ali Doff, who, as she puts it, is in charge of making sure the house doesn't fall apart.
We've had some boiler explosions before, and leaky ceilings, and broken windows that let lots of drafts in.
Fixing these problems requires keeping up with the many historical codes that come with living in a historic building.
Right now we're in the process of getting all new windows, and we have to get all that approved through the Historical Society.
These challenges, however, help bring the Student Co-op's residents together, according to Ali's fellow co-oper, Alex.
It's just a really cool energy to know that this has been here since before World War I, which is so much of what we're about, is just being an inclusive, peaceful space, and it's just a huge part of the energy here to know that it's been here for that long.
Xiao Wu, who moved into the co-op after hearing about it from her friends, agrees that the building has a peaceful atmosphere.
I really appreciate the simple things, that how you spend a lot of time just around the kitchen and enjoying, like, everybody come home together and, you know, preparing food, and we'll just sit around together and talk.
In fact, most co-opers tend to agree on what their favorite parts of living at the co-op are, most of the time.
What's your favorite part of collective living?
Maintenance projects.
Maintenance projects, for sure. Yeah, it's more independent. You feel like you have more control over your living space than you would at, like, an apartment or someplace with a landlord.
And I notice you have a disembodied hand up here. Like, what's with this thing?
That was an ornament on our Christmas tree this year, as well as some other weird things. Try to keep it kind of unusual around here.
Plastic zombie arms are just one of the shared oddities that give the student co-op a sense of close-knit community. Zach Taylor, who lives in Frontier Hall, says there isn't always such a strong connection with people in the dorms.
I feel like it's more pockets of people knowing each other. It's not really a whole floor that's connected, but I'm connected to, you know, my neighbors on my floor, just not everyone.
But he also claims that there are some advantages to this.
I feel like it's fine the way it is. I like the people that I know on the floor, and it also gives me kind of ability to kind of have a little bit more of a private life as well, and not always being bombarded by people.
Though the student co-op distinguishes itself from fraternities by offering co-ed habitation and independence from a larger organization, according to Ali, a shared focus on inclusive community living is a key part of both lifestyles, and it isn't a universal taste.
I've considered fraternity, but it just doesn't really seem to fit what I want out of college and my lifestyle. But when it comes to like an apartment, I've strongly considered that, you know, getting together with a group of people and either buying a house or an apartment.
With rent ranging between $265 and $330 a month, however, the student co-op is not short on new roommates despite the prevalence of other, perhaps more mainstream, housing options in the area.
Recently we've gotten a lot of applications, and unfortunately it is a little bit competitive. We get your application and we read through it and we vote on whether you seem like a good fit, and then you come to like a meal or come to meet some of the co-opers and we get to know you a little bit more, and we vote you into the co-op.
You could say that jumping into something as unconventional as cooperative living requires an adventurous spirit. This was definitely on display when Xiao Wu decided to try switching roles with me.
Could I ask you some questions?
Oh, okay.
What's your name?
My name's Parker Lemke.
So I guess you're with Radio K. What department do you...
Culture Q.
Culture Q.
Yeah, the radio, the culture show that rocks.
And that's me signing off.
I am an opera singer. I stand on painted tape. It tells me where I'm going and where to throw my
cape. In the 1800s, opera might have been the pinnacle of cool, but that's not so true today. On MTV, opera programming has stayed consistently low, somewhere around 0 hours in its weekly block. And let's be honest, many of us had never even stepped foot in an opera house. Whether that's because we're afraid that it will be expensive, or that we won't understand what's going on, or worst of all, that it might be boring, it's just not happening. But one University of Minnesota student says that our preconceived notions are wrong. She's asking us to quit being prima donnas and start loving opera. Producer Amy Friedman has the story.
My rehearsals last for hours and hours with diligence. I have been blessed.
It's not really something you vocalize to your peers a whole lot.
Well, the rest of the world was talking about the antics of Miley Cyrus. Rachel Schindler was talking with her friends about Giacomo Puccini.
Well, a few friends of mine and I, in our freshman year, discovered that we all enjoyed opera, which is pretty rare for people our age. And so they formed the student group, the Opera Appreciation Club. Their group has grown a lot over the past 3 years, but Schindler says it is not easy selling opera to college kids.
Some people hate. Some people judge. Well, sometimes they're just like, oh, but their voices go so high, it's terrible, it makes me cringe, but... I don't see what their problem is.
The Minnesota Opera Center had this exact problem in mind when they launched a program they call Project 20-something.
And it's basically a program to get younger people involved in opera. And so, you pay $20, only you get like a better seat than just, you know, the $20 seats.
Before this program, young people in their 20s made up the smallest demographic of opera goers, only 3 or 4%. That percentage doubled in the first year of the program. One of the ways they did this is by making the opera experience just a little bit cooler.
And then they also have like this after party for you. So it's at this Japanese restaurant in the area. all the cast members go there after the opera, so you get to see the people who are on stage. We went this past spring. They put out a ton of food. We got free food. They had dancing. They had a bar. They had photographers.
Rachel and her friends don't fit into our usual stereotypes about opera fans. She's no snob, and she's not out of touch.
I love hip-hop music. I love funk jazz. like Vampire Weekend is one of my favorites. Blind Pilot. Just all these, like, random... I love other music, but it's just, you know, opera is kind of underappreciated, so I like to get the word out more about it.
Schindler isn't out of touch with her generation, but neither is opera. We think of opera as an art form stuck in time. Stagnant. But Daniel Zillman, communications manager for the Minnesota Opera Center, explains why these are not your great-great-great-grandma's operas.
I think it's becoming more cinematic. It's not just, you know, three-dimensional sets. It's more into that kind of design work.
Their upcoming performance, The Magic Flute, is one of these operas of the future.
That is going to be using 3D animated projections throughout the entire opera that the singers are going to be working with. It's going to be a very cool production that I think everyone's going to love.
Zillman prides his opera company on how they've been able to keep up with contemporary culture, not fight against it.
There are not a lot of really successful kind of brand new written pieces that don't have some kind of connection to contemporary culture, because that's what brings people in.
For example, this year, they performed the opera Doubt, based on the film starring Philip Seymour Hoffman. But if even these stories fail to connect with 20-somethings, the Opera Center is prepared to scare young people into loving opera.
We're starting that all up with a commission of The Shining, Stephen King's The Shining, which is going to be awesome. I think it's going to be great for the art form to have a new, you know, horror opera.
Here's Johnny!
But even with all of these innovations, keeping up with the times doesn't necessarily mean letting go of the old. At least, not for our young aficionado, Schindler.
I mean, I personally really like the old ones because I love Italian, and not a whole lot of the new ones are in Italian. I love the comedy ones. They just, the humor back then still applies today. It's still so funny, and then, you know, they're making all these Shakespearean-type jokes, you know, and you're laughing at something stupid, but it's still funny.
Schindler loves opera so much that not only is she okay with the haters, but she thinks they're in denial.
Don't be embarrassed. We all love opera. Let's face it.
For Culture Q, I'm Amy Friedman.
You're listening to Culture Q on Radio K. My name is Mitch. I am joined in studio with Jamie for the top seven this week. How are you doing today, Jamie?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. All right, so let's get right into it. We are celebrating back to school, or maybe dreading back to school. So we're going to count down the top seven places you can go to on campus, but probably shouldn't. Our number seven place you can go to on campus, but probably shouldn't, is free dining hall access. Specifically, places like Comstock, you can just pick up a plate and pretend like you already swiped your card and go back for more food. I'm using quote fingers right here because you can go back for your first helping without even paying. There's also places where you can just sneak in the back, but there's always the risk of getting caught. And, you know, it's not a very moral thing to do.
That sounds great to me.
Yeah. All right. So
so number six is first floor of the Kauffman Union, more specifically anywhere near the piano, where students will play any top 40 hits on the piano for you. So you could be reading Shakespeare and you have to listen to Had a Bad Day on the piano. It's distracting.
So avoid the first floor. Number five place you can go to on campus but probably shouldn't.
St. Paul.
Yep, just don't go there. We're kidding you. We love our neighbors to the east, but still probably don't go to St. Paul. Number four place you can go to on campus, but probably shouldn't, is the Armory.
Last time, and only time I went to the Armory, I just got off the bus and I was trying to find a bathroom desperately, and I stumbled into the armory and I was completely confused. I was walking around trying to find the bathroom, couldn't find it, and ran across all these people in sweatsuits working out.
Yeah, they weren't too friendly, huh?
I don't remember.
Well, just in case, you probably don't want to disturb our men in uniform or sweatpants, as it were. So just avoid the armory.
They'll help you find the bathroom, but I don't know how excited they are to help you find the bathroom.
So there you go. Number three place you can go to, but probably shouldn't, Tate. It's the science-y building over in the mall area. It's got radioactive materials. You know, it's pretty crazy time with those particle accelerators. You don't want to be caught when conditions are right and those particle accelerators make a black hole, because I've heard that being in a black hole, while it might be a cool way to die, it will certainly kill you and it will be painful.
I mean, you get to step into a new universe, but the likelihood of you surviving is very slim.
Oh, for sure. For sure. You'll be ripped apart. Number two is various roofs you can get to on campus. Maybe I shouldn't tell you exactly how to get to these places, but I've been to several of them. They include the Philip Wangenstein building, which is right next to Moose Tower. But that involves going into a closet and walking on a bunch of catwalks to get there. You have to climb up a couple ladders. It's pretty crazy. But it's about the tallest place you can get to on campus anymore. So I'm not recommending this. This is a place you shouldn't go. You can also get on like Tate and Territorial and also Frontier. But with Frontier, I remember my freshman year, there were stories about some kids at the move-out time were getting on the roof. They get kicked out a week early during finals. So don't go on the roofs. You might get kicked out of your living area. And our number one place you can go to on campus but should not this week is
the Cook Hall pool. If you go to this pool, you might notice that it looks like the set of every horror film where you've seen somebody who gets drowned and comes back to life and crawls out of the pool and haunts you.
Yeah, I do not want anyone haunting me when I go to the pool, but that's just me.
Also, the deck is so high up from the water, it's so hard to get out of the pool that you basically have to, with all your might, pull yourself out and kind of beat yourself like a whale to get out. Or you have to find one of the really tall ladders to get out of the pool.
Well, there you have it, our top seven for this week. For Culture Q, I'm Mitch.
And I'm Jamie.
Keep on listening.
I'm just coming here to come down. I could be here, and I could move town. Put my suits right on the gas lamp.
So college is supposed to be a time of discovery and growing up, but often students go in the opposite direction. They want to recapture that youthful bliss of childhood, so they play games. Kid games like Tag or Nerf Guns or Foursquare. Zach McCormick jumps right into the court with the U of M Foursquare Club.
Some children were blessed with the athletic ability required to play baseball or football on the playground. The rest of us played Foursquare. David Salm was the visionary that brought this sport of gentlemen, nay, champions, to our fair university.
Well, my freshman year, my friends and I all discovered that we loved playing Foursquare. We looked online and saw that there was no Foursquare club at the university, so we decided, what the heck, let's make one.
To David, Foursquare is more than just an easily learned playground activity.
Well, it's a very social game. I mean, some people are very intense, but there's always room to talk. There's plenty of downtime, and it's not too stressful.
The club meets weekly in a variety of locations and sometimes hosts tournaments in addition to their usual pickup games. While they adhere to a set of rules created by the club, I decided to run a few of my old playground trick rules by David to see if they'd fly in the big leagues.
Black magic.
We tried that once, but we didn't really like it that much.
Puppy chow.
I've not heard of that one.
Double taps?
I think we did something like that, but
underhandsies.
I don't think we tried that one either.
Red magic.
Not that one either.
Snake eyes. Body language.
Wow.
What's your stance on cherry bombs?
We frown on those.
For Culture Q, I'm Zach McCormick.
At this point in the college semester, it's kind of necessary to get into a good rhythm, because it's not only the color of leaves that change in the fall, it's everything for students. Making time for homework, juggling classes and extracurricular activities, there's employment and hopefully even a social life. Needless to say, many students find this overwhelming, and some are turning to Eastern teachings for guidance. Reporter Maddie Hamilton takes us to Uptown to learn how the Diamond Way Buddhist Student Group uses teachings and meditation to achieve peace of mind.
The Diamond Way Buddhist Center in Uptown Minneapolis is located on 1701 West Lake Street. A sign bearing the Diamond Way logo marks what otherwise appears to be a beige house covered in vines. In recent years, the center has served as a meeting place for members of the U of M's Diamond Way Buddhist Student Group, supplementing weekly meditation held at Kauffman Union.
It's really to extend the activity of the center beyond the walls or behind this, beyond the space that we have here.
This is Jesse Starbuck, a Diamond Way Buddhist and U of M student who lives at the center. On campus, he reaches out to other students to connect them with meditation and the Buddhist method.
I think it can be helpful if you have something that can help you calm down sometimes, or you know, give you space where you can kind of get away from your studies or kind of the hectic life that can happen on campus.
Members of the Diamond Way Buddhist Center practice Buddhism of the Karma Kagyu tradition. Teachings directed by the center's founder, Lama Ule Nidal, are used with group meditation in over 500 locations all over the world. Paul Rauser is a University of Minnesota professor of Asian languages and literatures who specializes in Buddhism.
But the Buddha was primarily concerned with what he perceived of as the central problem of human existence, which was dukkha in Sanskrit. It's also any type of discontent or anguish or the realization that your life is unsatisfactory.
According to Rauser, Buddhists believe that it is possible to transcend this suffering by learning the Buddhist teachings. One must reach a relaxed state of mind to contemplate them. This is meditation.
And wisdom is the idea that you understand the Buddhist teachings, you can meditate on them and think about them in an intellectual sense. But just thinking about them isn't good enough. Meditation is the practice.
At the Uptown Center, meditation sessions are held 3 nights a week. Each begins with a short introductory talk that progresses into guided meditation. Participants close their eyes and contemplate the Buddha's teachings as they are read by a group leader. Afterwards, members are allowed to relax, ask questions, and socialize. Student group officer Jody Rader became interested in Buddhism after studying Eastern art history as a U of M undergraduate.
And I thought it would be interesting to sort of find out what people were doing today. And so I started going to the meditation on campus.
After becoming a Diamond Way Buddhist, she benefited from its methods.
I really found that, it worked for my situation, even though I didn't realize that I was really looking for something. But what I noticed was that things that once were really disturbing and dramatic in my life weren't so dramatic anymore.
Starbuck, the U of M Buddhist who lives at the center, described the mindset he achieved from Buddhism this way.
You definitely experience things less personally. You don't feel so much like you're the target of the world, that all these bad things are happening to you, and you really start to open up, and you really do see opportunities to where you can benefit others.
Rader strongly encourages students interested in Buddhism to join the group or visit the Uptown Center on their own.
It's really important, I think, to find a good group to practice with, because meditation isn't easy, and it does take quite a bit of motivation. You know, it's like going to the gym. You want to try to do it every day. You don't want to just try to sit down and get enlightened in one weekend. That won't happen. Well, for most of us, probably not. But it's good to have a group of people to help you kind of keep a steady and focused practice. And these are friends that you'll probably have for a lifetime.
For Culture Q, I'm Maddie Hamilton.
While many student groups at the University of Minnesota offer students the freedom to test the waters or come and go as they please, not all groups are so lenient. In fact, there's one group in particular that's a little more strict about its members going AWOL. I'm talking about the ROTC. And frankly, sometimes we civilian students forget how much work our uniformed colleagues are putting in. So reporter Emma Nelson decided to find out just how these students manage to get it all done.
The Reserve Officer Training Corps, or ROTC, is located in the Armory on the U of M's East Bank. It's a large golden brick building, almost like a castle. An American flag flies from the highest turret, and inside, uniformed students practice marching drills in the gym.
We give students the opportunity to lead each other, both in what we call a garrison, which is normal day-to-day stuff, and we put them in stressful situations.
That's Cole Herring, one of the cadets I was able to speak with.
Combat scenarios where you have an op four, which is an enemy, and you receive a mission and you're on a strict timeline to come up with a plan. And during the mission, sometimes they'll notionally kill members of the squad.
Cole joined ROTC after already having been deployed. He enlisted in the military right after high school.
I joined the military originally because I'll back up a little bit. Don't take this the wrong way, but basically I love America. And I wanted to represent what America stood for, which is freedom.
Have people taken it the wrong way, or what's the response you've gotten to that?
Most people don't ask me why I joined originally, but when I say I love America, I don't want to come off like I'm being arrogant or just being a big patriot.
I love my country, and I love, you know, the military, and I wanted to, you know, I don't feel like anything is free.
That's Sapuo Roberts, who, like Swenson, joined the military after high school.
Like that whole thing of me developing as a person and as a man and where I wanted to go and how I wanted to be, and also the extra benefits that they had provided, and, you know, decided that was the route that I wanted to go to develop myself.
Both Roberts and Swenson ended up being deployed. Roberts almost immediately after joining, and Swenson a little later. Again, Sapuo Roberts.
I went to Iraq. I was 18 years old. I was stationed in Baghdad.
When I first deployed, I was 22.
Again, that was Cole Swenson.
I was excited because the whole reason I joined was to do my part.
This is the reason that all the cadets I spoke with gave for wanting to deploy, including Sean Tisdell. Tisdell is also the only one of the three to have joined the military after college.
I was in an economics degree here at St. Paul campus at the University of Minnesota, and it just, the prospects and how my life was going, my parents got divorced, it just, finally I hit a tipping point and I was decided to finally do what I wanted to. And I enlisted, became an air traffic controller.
2 weeks before he would have deployed to Afghanistan, Tisdell was admitted into an ROTC program called Green and Gold, which now pays for his graduate school.
It's been 1 year since they left, so they'll be coming back within a couple of weeks. And so I'm sure I'll see him at some point. I do talk to him still, though. They've called me a few times. It's not really easy for me to call them, but I could also talk to them on Facebook, little things, emails.
The camaraderie amongst the members of the unit they trained with is something that all three men could attest to. Here's Cole Swenson.
Well, you definitely get to know everybody extremely well. For me personally, we developed a strong bond within our team.
It is this very bond, though, that can make it difficult to return to civilian life.
And so initially to come on campus, it was kind of tough because there's really, you know, nobody that I really could relate to, because you understand that me as a soldier, I went through a kind of a different type of maturation process than a normal student would. A normal student, you go through high school, then you go to college, and then you go to the workforce, whereas I went straight from high school straight to workforce, not just any workforce. I went into the United States Army.
And it's not just other students who don't understand. Tisdell's wife is a civilian, and he says it can be hard to explain why his job has to come before everything else.
I try to explain it, but when I tell her I have to do something, she's like, well, she doesn't understand that I have to do it.
If the Army says, hey, we need you, then I'm going to go and be there. You know, as a military, we go off what the government decides, and and if the governor decides that we need to go somewhere, we go there and we do our job the best we can. And if the governor decides that we don't need to be somewhere, then we, you know, we go back home and continue preparing it if we are needed again.
For Culture Q, I'm Emma Nelson.
You were a brick bat, a Bowery tough, so rough. They called you from a cartoon, pulled out of your pantaloons. But you, my brother in arms.
And that's it for this week's Culture Q. Tonight you heard stories from Parker Lemke, Amy Friedman, Mitch Skinner, Jamie Nelson, Zach McCormick, Maddie Hamilton, and Emma Nelson. Producers for Culture Q are Markita Fornoff, Amy Friedman, and Matt Curtis. Our culture coach is Sarah Lemanchek, and I'm Mitch Skinner. Culture Q is online at RadioK.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. And we'll be back on your radio next Sunday at 6 p.m. with a special quiz show. We'll see you then.
In the trenches, gazing on the battlefield, our rifles blaze away. We blaze away.
Support for this program is brought to you by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.